Hi there, my name's Oisin Lunny and welcome to Audio Talks, presented to you by Harman. And in this episode, we're going to get up close and personal with one of the most enigmatic names in dance music, nightlife and DJing. I am, of course, talking about the man, the myth, the legend, the secret DJ. Welcome to the podcast, sir.
Oish, you're the Terry Wogan of techno.
Oh my God, that's a keeper.
You're so good at it. You're so good at this.
That is very kind of you, sir.
I can feel you touching my knee and you're like 1,000 miles away.
Excellent. Oh, geez, thank you. First time I've been blushing on this podcast. Good result already. So listeners, extra special measures are being taken to protect the identity of the secret DJ, and you'll discover why it is a very hotly kept secret in the industry. Our cameras are all off, and we had a sticker put on our smartphone cameras here by a very imposing bouncer on the way in. We're here in the dark room and we're ready to go. So my first question to you, why are you the secret DJ and when did it all start?
I've been a writer for a really long time. And, yeah. And even when I wasn't doing journalism, as it were, I was just would write anyway. I just come from a generation when you used to write things down and still do, you know?
Yeah.
I started with DJ Mag doing almost like an agony aunt thing a long time ago. It must have been 20 years ago. So I got into that kind of groove of giving DJs advice and usually humorously, you know, because it's, you can be a little bit stuck up if you're sort of putting yourself in the teacher role. So just we do it funny bits of advice as well. And then Duncan was the editor of Mix Mag. Obviously, lots changed since COVID. So a lot of things are in past tense now, but maybe I'll just imagine COVID never happened. And Duncan was like, you know, we should do something in Mix Mag that's like that thing you used to do, like the Agony Aunt thing. And then we just started talking about, you know, doing a book. And we went to quite a few, I say we, I had also a literary agent. And we went to he said every single publisher in the UK, and none of them wanted to do a they said music books are dead. Nobody reads music books. They don't sell. We're not interested. So I went to Faber and Faber, a very big publisher, one of the biggest.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, we do have Mixmag behind us. Mixmag will serialize this thing. And then suddenly they are bling, like their ears popped up and they were like, well, yeah, we're interested in that. Cause obviously, you know, it's a new market for them. People who don't read to sell books to kids who don't discos who've grown up reading only their mobile phones. But it all kind of snowballed from there. And a lot of encouragement came from Duncan, who's a good egg. And it was a lot of his encouragement, you know. And then I started to do more hardcore reportage, including writing for Private Eye and also for DJ Mag around the Me Too time. So we did some very serious things about rape and about safety in the workplace in dance music and also racism, which we were all raising their head. If you remember, suddenly the tip of the berg just emerged from the seas a few years ago, and this mad culture war thing started. So obviously, even in the 1980s, when the whole thing started, we were very much on the side of woke, whatever that means, which I understand means generally to be a good person.
Yeah.
And I was in this sort of zone of wanting to do Private Eye, but for our dance music scene, as it were, which seemed quite silly, and I couldn't sell it to anyone. Because the biggest problem with the music industry is the music industry. It's not interested in change in any way whatsoever. It's interested in money, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And so eventually took it on myself and started to do the secret DJ, ostensibly as a whistleblower, a kind of person who would talk the truth, a voice, because there's more than one. There's not just me. I mean, other people would contribute and it would be an outlet for that. So people do conflate the secret DJ project into a single person, and that person is me, but I am not the sum total of the secret DJ. It's a project, you know. And there, so it was kind of a combination of fighting the good fight plus daft stories. You know, I became, if you like, a pundit. As I became more and more elderly, like a footballer, like my legs went, and I became a sort of talking in the studio like a kind of Gary Lineker, but without any of the skill.
Phenomenal. Brilliant. And folks listening, we will be linking, of course, to the Secret DJ's website. There's a whole archive, a treasure trove of articles. And like you kind of hinted to there, you did do a lot of very important work for the industry to drag it into the modern age. And the stuff around Me Too was shocking, refreshing, important.
Well, hats off to Carl Lober for that, because he was probably the only editor who was simultaneously keen to do this. I mean, Cal Loban really pushed the boat out to actually talk about these things. And we had some like big 6-page spreads about racism and things like that going on in DJ Mag. So I'm doffing my digital hat to Cal right now because he put his neck on the block for that one. And it's quite scary because obviously there's quite a lot of big sharks swimming around the cage and you're sat in there with sort of sandwiches tied to your tits. It's like, you know, there's a bunch of hungry sharks circling. And the trick is just to remember that, you know, in a sense, this sort of whole sort of libel thing is a bit like money. It kind of doesn't exist. It's very much kind of, if you're of the opinion or if you work in the world of finance and you kind of understand this really fun, it's a bit like swimming. When you're a kid, you're petrified of putting your head under the water. And all of a sudden, one day, you're like a little otter. You know, you're just flipping about with your little hands opening rocks on your tummy. And there's this thing of a fundamental in finance, which is understanding that money isn't real. It also kind of exists in the legal profession where if you understand how it works and if, like me, you've actually been to a libel court, you realize just how simple it all is, and that, you know, really it only really exists for the very rich. Yes. So somebody in our dance music scene, they don't have that sort of money to actually bend the truth. So if you go to them and say, okay, well, sue me then, because you'll have to prove it's not true, and that's when it all stops and grinds to a halt, and they're like, oh right, yeah, because then I'll be there with the grown-ups and I'll have to tell the truth. So there's this sort of,
fantastic,
you know, weird thing of sort of fear. There's fear everywhere, fears with small f. People absolutely petrified of telling the truth, the truth being completely dispensed with now in the post-truth era with your Trumps and your Johnsons. Sure. And in fact, it's completely turned like Alice through the looking glass, and now it's like anybody who tells the truth is the villain.
Yeah, you're not wrong, mate. Yeah. But rewinding a little bit back to that, you know, when you were the secret DJ, and you were, of course, a very well-known DJ, but you're also a very well-known musician. So how did you move from the world of making music as a recording artist to the world of DJing, and what was the overlap there?
It happened to me, basically. Nice. It's like, you know, what they say about discovering America, you know, Plymouth Rock landed on them, you know. It's probably impossible to describe to someone now how trivial we used to think playing records was, and also conversely, how important music was. So everybody played in bands. Bands was everything. You played records just before the gig and just after. And sometimes, you know, there was the carpet and chrome discos in town, which would refuse anybody of colour, anybody who didn't have the right shoes on or the right trousers. And it was kind of basically for kind of fairly well-off white people. And, you know, we were kind of punks, really. We were the new wave post-punk kind of era of the late 70s, early 80s. And we'd go to the West Indian Center and the Polish Center because we couldn't get into the carpet and chrome places. And the whole thing was very much bands and music industry. And all of a sudden, the DJ thing started to take off. And we, you know, obviously we knew a lot about music and we had a lot of records because we were musicians and we played in bands. And then we just started, it was a very weird thing. Like we almost unnoticeably over a couple of years, we were just playing less and less gigs and more DJ gigs. And the rave thing, you know, it was very hand in hand with the kind of legit rock scene. People kind of airbrushed that out a little bit where, you know, the people who provided the sound systems for the early raves were the same roadies who did the rock bands, you know, and the sort of the buses that you got in and you went to see The Wedding Present and Cud and all these kind of 80s indie bands around the north of England, you know, were also the same people who started the raves doing things in Blackburn and Manchester and Leeds and Sheffield, way ahead of London, which obviously London vociferously denies and hates with a passion, you know. It's that thing of, it was just another level of the music thing. You know, it was just new music. Yeah. It was, you know, there was a lot of kind of indie bands that had sequencers and they were playing with MIDI drums and stuff. There's a narrative that the whole thing just arrived incredibly clean, imported from Chicago, Boff, and everybody had the right clothes on immediately, and everybody wore a bandana, had a smiley face. And I didn't experience any of that. I experienced music from Europe, and it was, you know, Giorgio Moroder and Krautrock and the Young Gods from Switzerland and Neubauten, you can't even pronounce it, and Front 242 and Belgian New Beat and all these things that were, it was a very big, very broad palette, very big melting pot of things that came along. And I just was just a spotted little Herbert in a studio, you know, trying to decipher Japanese manuals. I mean, when people talk about the race of it, you know, obviously there's a lot of black culture in America now reclaiming this and saying, this is our music. We, you know, and that's completely valid as well, because there has been a huge whitewashing of it. But what about the Japanese people who invented all the kits? It's like all stories. You can't polarize it. It's extremely complicated, and somebody should write a book.
Well said. R.I.P. Ryuichi Sakamoto, sadly passed away last week. Absolutely one of the pioneers. But speaking of stories that are often simplified, I mean, the legend of Ibiza is something that dance music comes back to again and again. But you were out there early doors, and you actually relocated there at some stage. So talk to us a bit about your journey to Ibiza. What was it like in the early days?
Well, again, there's a sort of established narrative of, you know, four humble Londoners went there and then they invented acid house. You know, and it's just, it did happen. But the thing is, the people who push this narrative do it at the expense of everything else. They say, this is what happened and nothing else happened. And what I'm saying is, yes, that happened, and lots of other things at the same time. You know, there's a big thing about, you know, Sheffield Scallies who used to sell pills in San Antonio, and they were very, they drove dance music much harder in the UK than people give credit for. Sheffield was ground zero for electronic music, as far as I'm concerned. I'm not from Sheffield. People might think I am, I'm not. But without question, there was records coming out that were deeply electric in the mid to late 70s from Sheffield.
Yeah.
Long before anything happened, was imported from America. So, you know, it's a fact. But what you get with these sort of established narratives, which are always written by the victors, but it's a much, much broader story, much, much broader, huge in scope and completely undocumented, which is one of the reasons why I got into the books. But I mean, with Ibiza, I mean, my journey with it was probably very much like everybody else's. I was just, a dirty little scrote who was, you know, plotting about eating, could only afford sandwiches. They used to call us Los Bocadillos, the sandwich kids. You know, we can only afford sandwiches. And, and we'd go into places, you know, have you got a bocadillo? Probably the only word we knew, cerveza and bocadillo. And it's, we were the Los Bocadillos. So now it's the other day, somebody referred to us or to tourists as Las Piernas Blancas, which is the white legs, which is always a really nice way of putting it.
Quality.
And so I didn't have a special relationship with anything, with music. I didn't start anything. I'm not an originator. I'm just another tourist, just somebody else who was along for the ride. I had a slightly deranged and toxic relationship with Ibiza since day one. You know, I was a pillager like everyone else and, deeply disrespectful, did loads of free parties. I mean, I spent an entire decade pretty much doing free parties all across Ibiza, which I noticed, which I just stopped almost like one day on a dime because I just was walked into one of them and like people were pulling decorations down, licking their own eyeballs, parking at a triangular angle like a copper in the middle of the road and caught, you know, and it was just an absolute madhouse and absolutely nobody was going, gosh, I bet this took a lot of time and effort and money. You know, it's just where nobody was doing that. And I realized, what am I doing this for? Why am I doing this for free for people for so long when they kind of think it appears like the rave pixies do it? You know, it's like I woke up one day and all my shoes were cobbled. You know, I walked out of the disco and suddenly there was an after party and like magic and, you know, Merlin the DJ did it. And it's that kind of thing where you were kind of, I've always been a slightly anonymous figure and that's completely deliberate since day one. You know, you can't move through something. It's a bit like when Wile E. Coyote is covered in quick drying cement and he turns into a statue. And once you're in that statue, you can never get out of it. You'll be a trance DJ or a boyzone football pioneer or, you know, you will wear that hat for life. So I was very aware since day one that I didn't ever want to be in anybody's gang. You know, that was, and it was also important not to get arrested. So you had to be anonymous so that, you know, and the, one of the last ones I did was in at Talamanca Beach. And I knew they were coming because they send the jolly squad first. You've seen them at Glastonbury. You know, they send these sort of slightly Father Christmas-esque coppers around and they point and poke at the beads and say, oh, this has got a good beat. And they're just the intelligence corps. They're doing a recce and the rabid killers are in the next field banging their shields against their faces, you know, ready to come. Yeah, so we had these jolly fellas arrive one week and I was like, next week we're going to get shut down. And my partner was like, oh, don't be so paranoid. I said, next week we're going to get shut down. And like clockwork, the Guard of Seville arrived, you know, pushing people around and everything. So I knew they were coming. I just knew it in the depths of my heart. And I put on KRS One sound of the police and went, whoop, whoop, that's the sound of the police. And Billy, it did not endear me to them one bit. And obviously, you know, 1,000 Hmongs kind of pointing in the faces, going, whoop, whoop. So one of them pointed at me and he did the sort of slicey, slicey neck, neck thing.
Oh, dear. And they took us off to the
to the really dirty police station that used to be up by the McDonald's roundabout. Oof. They've cleaned it up now, but it was used to be a horrible concrete bunker. They made me put all the stuff in the van and unload all the van. I was sweating and I got in there and there was this big jolly fellow called Juan. I'll never forget him. They rotate the police so they don't work the same district, anti-corruption thing. But he was here for a while and he was head of vice and he hated breaking up the bikes because he didn't care. He had real problems, you know. Yeah. And we walked in there. And he's like, in Spanish, he's like, so what's this electro? You come to the right place, man. And about fast forward about 20 minutes and we've got half the equipment plugged in and I'm like playing these records. I'm going, all right, lads, this is electro, not to be confused with electro, and don't get me started on Deep House. And then my partner come in and she walks in the door and there's like a couple of coppers doing the chicken dance, you know. I've got my top off. Fantastic. And, you know, like a little police station rave and Juan goes and goes, if you come for him, and she was like, yeah, I'm sorry. She was like, yeah, get, yeah, I'll take him. And every time then when he turned up, he just sort of, you know, he was like, oh, you. So yeah, funnily enough, you know, if you're nice to him and you speak Spanish and you're not a kid who shouts at them in welding volume English, that you can actually have a relationship with them. But sadly, they don't do the job forever. So yeah. I've had a turbulent, and ironically, I'm now getting full karma payback. Because I'm now the grumpy old man who can't handle noise. I spent a lifetime making noise in Ibiza, and now I'm just like, what is that? That, you know, just somewhere in the distance. I'm like, no, you know. It's pure justice.
Full circle.
It's pure justice. Yeah. So now it's like I can't handle it because I don't know about you, and this is proper old man stuff. But people do seem to have completely lost decorum. There used to be a thing where, and now there's this thing where, you know, people will literally, you know, have a raging conversation or on WhatsApp right next to you in a plane or be watching porn or something. There's like to everybody, the whole world is their front room and they can do anything they want in it. And my thing is, because I live in the castle in Don't Villa, is that we don't get a lot of tourists because it's a little bit hot and a little bit high up. Yeah. And that's also not an accident. And I just find that because I'm surrounded by churches as well, it's quite peaceful up here. You know, but it's very easy to pierce that piece by coming up, you know, lobster red, waving a pipe pot around. And I get stick from this on the internet, like people, you're always dissing the kids. And it's like, no, I'm just dissing rampaging quadraspasmed idiots. There's an irony there, a deep irony.
Oh, well, full circle. But I'd like to come back to your book, The Secret DJ. You got a trilogy of books, volumes 1 to 3, and no less a man than Andrew Weatherall, the governor, rest in peace, himself. He quoted William Blake when talking about your first book, The Secret DJ, and he said something along the lines of, the road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom. You never know what is enough until you know what is more than enough. When hedonism turned to decadence, I made my excuses and left. The Secret DJ stayed at the party and now sends an insightful, scabrous and darkly beautiful written report that lends weight to Mr. Blake's aphorism. So for the uninitiated, how would you describe your trilogy, The Secret DJ?
It's nice to hear. Andrew was a one of a kind, you know. I've never been part of the Church of Weatherall. I always used to joke that he was a cult figure, you know, and he was a very kindly, very funny, very relaxed individual, and probably the opposite of most of his most deranged followers, you know. We weren't close, but he was a friend of mine, and he was very kind to me before The Secret DJ and after. And and a very wise and very well-read and interesting person as well. And it's good to hear those words.
Ah, for sure. Yeah. Well said. No, it was really like, how would you describe the trilogy? I mean, he gives a great description there of there's, you know, there's a lot of excess in the book, you know, but like, how would you kind of sum it up for the uninitiated?
They're just a bunch of funny stories. You know, I mean, they're straight up reality. They're just a series of things that happened. For something like the 60s, there's a vast amount, huge bibliographies of books and magazines and films and TV series and an entire industry of nostalgia for something like the 1960s, which was only 10 years long. And ours is huge. It's like 30, 40 years and going, carrying on, and a vast thing, and almost unreported. It's as if it's not never happened. There's a handful of awful films. There's some very sort of, how could we put this kindly, journalistic books, apart from Bill Bruce's one, which is extremely comprehensive and something amazing. Of a Bible, you know, and they kind of, and I just, as somebody who didn't, I lived it. I wasn't just a DJ, you know, it was like my entire life. I didn't know anybody outside dance music. I spent every living moment inside of it. And it just didn't feel authentic. Any of these things, any of the films, never seen a film that represents it. Maybe 24 Hour Party People, you know, maybe one time. But they're so wide of the mark, so wide, so completely not getting it in all forms of media. So there was an element of just trying to do it right. Like saying, you know, I was there and this is what happened. So it's a reportage basically, but it's also very highly edited. You know, obviously the funniest bits, this thing that happened there didn't happen 5 minutes after this happened. So there's a lot of kind of compression of the timeline, if you like, and merge. I mean, otherwise it'd be like Lord of the fucking Rings, 3,000 million words later. You know, it's that sort of thing. So it had to be compressed. And because I'd done quite a lot of writing, I didn't find that part difficult. You know, it's the editing is the hardest thing you can do to yourself, isn't it? Locked in a room editing yourself madly. Sweating. It's again, I suppose the comparison is a bit like being the pundit thing, you know. I was always a DJ and always a musician, but I was always a writer at the same time, in the same way that a footballer who likes a pint might open a pub when his legs finally give in, you know. That was me, where I never thought, oh, one day I'm gonna fall back on the writing thing. It just, we put it out there and eventually we found a publisher. It was Lee Braxton. He was at Faber and Faber then. He's now got his own imprint, White Rabbit Books, and he specializes pretty much in music things. He was the conduit for it. You know, he was like, I believe in this and we can make it happen. And you've always got to have that guy, you know, or nothing gets done in the music industry and in the literary fields. And it's interesting as well, again, talking about the internet, there's a lot of people who have a very strong opinion about me online who've never read anything I've written or heard me DJ. So it's that's very interesting as well, how you can have a very strong opinion about something you've no experience of. Another complex thing, it's not that simple, not a simple answer. Huh.
Indeed. And White Rabbit Books, one of my favourite publishers. They've published so many great books and they really are doing a service for music
lovers. Because
of
Lee, who's one of the good ones. And a good friend of Andrew. In fact, Andrew probably wouldn't have given me such a glowing testimonial if Lee hadn't sorted that out.
I'm sure he would have. No, Lee's an absolute a king amongst men. But talking again of Weatherall, I remember watching an interview we did, with an Australian journalist, and he was talking about the thing of going to a dark room in a club and dancing to repetitive beats, and you've got the smoke, and he kind of spoke about it as an echo of something very spiritual, like ancient Gnostic ceremonies. Did this approach come through to your own approach to DJing? Because I know you did a series of global club nights and they were quite special. Talk to us a bit about your philosophy.
I'm the opposite. I'm about as spiritual as a breeze block. And this is one of the things I used to gently rib Andrew about, that he could be quite florid about this. I think he just liked the word Gnostic. Because Gnosticism is, you know, it's a pre-Christian sect, you know, and it's about, I understand the thing about, if you like, they were the religious libertarians. They didn't believe in organized religion so much as a personal relationship with God and things like that. But, you know, that's a lot of old b***s, isn't it? Really. I mean, and also very limiting, because it didn't start in the second one AD, rather, you know, after Christ.
Yeah.
It's something that's gone back since the beginning of time. We've always knocked rocks together and we've always waggled our head from side to side to make ourselves high, or eaten weird plants. And, you know, it's as old as Homo sapiens. Probably minus the sapiens. I don't think you need to examine it too hardly. Although I would like, maybe if somebody has written a book about it, maybe that's a bit stupid.
No.
He's absolutely correct, but I would say it goes a bit further than that. And I mean, the idea for me about the dark room is that it just rolls back to when it was very primal, in the sense that when we first did raves, you didn't know who the DJ was. You didn't even know which direction to point in. There was very little in the way of lights. It was just music. You're absolutely blown away by the music. And there was zero show business. This kind of you know, society of the spectacle, Guy Debord thing of being absolutely obsessed with the spectacle of things is very toxic. You know, the bangers and the glitter, and it doesn't matter if David Guetta's mixer isn't plugged in as long as everybody's talking about it. You know, that kind of the reportage being more important than the actual thing. So we've moved away in every kind of aspect of our culture into this weird balloon of culture war and spectacle and nonsense, and we're about as far away from authenticity as we've ever been in my life. It's never been less authentic. I mean, you can see the reason why people are kind of hipsters with the beards and the, you know, with the workwear and stuff. It's a fake authenticity to fight this kind of plasticity of everything, and I completely understand why people do it. So the idea behind the darkroom thing is literally, it's just like, it's like 2001 A Space Odyssey. There's just four monoliths. It's completely pitch black, and we just, you can't see the DJ. I mean, we didn't invent it. I mean, it's great to see places like Fabric doing the no phones thing, but we're probably the only people who do the whole package of, you know, quadraphonic, unbilled acts, superstar soundman, Andy Kale, DJs behind a screen that you can't see, pitch black, no phones. Lots of people do one of those, or maybe even two, but nobody does all of them. And also, it's a very hard sell. We had kids crying because we were taking their phones off. It's like, no, honestly, it's just a disco. It's like, I mean, and it's, but I suppose it's a bit like an audio ghost train. You know, some people were quite frightened of this thing of like going so anywhere without their phone. I would also say, it was, without sounding too a little bit ahead of its time, being whatever, 5-6 years ago, but it might be a bit more relevant now post COVID, but it was very hard to sell to people and very expensive. You know, I mean, it's like we've got all the expenses of a normal gig, but we've also got like, you know, the best soundman in the world and a handmade sound system. And these things lose money. They don't make money. So one of my dad's nicknames for me is the Betamax kid. I've become a drummer as soon as drum machines are invented. You know, I start a record, start putting vinyl out as soon as Spotify comes along. You know, I've got this real, like, I'm like an albatross. It's like, as soon as anything happens in technology, I'll do the opposite, you know. So I was trying to sell, you know, no mobile phones to the mobile phone generation. So you know, selling books to the telephone generation. It's a superpower of goodness that I've got. But yeah, it was a very lofty, highfalutin idea, as they say, and I'll never be able to afford it again. You know, COVID was crippling, and 3 years without earning any money, there's no way I can pay people to have a good time again, which is what was happening with that. But I do think things have moved along a little bit. And now that places like Fabric are doing no phones, you know, and it's a little bit more in sync with the rest of the world.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you kind of mentioned there that obviously the pandemic really like blew a hole completely in the nightlife industry. Mm. And, you know, places closed down. DJs in particular had a really hard time. And, you know, you kind of finished that global tour of the dark room, you know, no phones, secret DJ club nights, you know, high end audio and all that kind of thing. But in 2023, you are back on the road. You've signed to one of the best booking agents in the business. And
yeah, but we're glossing over the part where it killed me. We're glossing over the part where my heart stopped, and they had to put their hand inside me and restart my heart. It was because the thing, COVID was like a huge pair of X-ray specs. We really got to see what this mad right-wing libertarian thing is. We really got to see the culture war writ large. And who'd have thought that, you know, half of the peace and love generation of Acid House would turn out to be swivel-eyed, frothing maniacs who didn't believe in COVID and were essentially right-wingers. It just was staggering. You know, let's all have a party right now. The great example is, of course, Zanzibar. The prime minister or president of Zanzibar decreed that COVID was not just non-existent, but illegal. It was against the law to have COVID, against the law to mention COVID. And like places like the people, that, for instance, in Tulum, these very, very rich people who are both industry and punter, sometimes they're indistinguishable from each other. The Tuluminati, I used to call them, would fly around the world to each of these places where it was, you know, inverted commas, legal to do it. And in Zanzibar, it's the guy serving you your coconut cocktail who die. It's never the rich people who've got private, you know, it's never the artists or the rich people who've got, you know, one or two vaccinations. It's always the poor people who die. So we've got, you know, very, very big DJs going to Zanzibar just so they can, and they're the ones who need money the least. Yeah. The richest of us are going there because they're more, far more interested in fame than in actual cash. One follows the other these days. Yeah. And eventually, the Prime Minister of Zanzibar died of COVID.
No.
Sorry, what? No, an undiagnosed, unspecified chest infection,
God,
or something like
so
that.
Dark, my goodness.
And so it was just, this is, people were dying by the millions.
Yes.
And it's, we've just literally, as a species, put our fingers in our ears and gone, la, 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 I can't hear you. And it's just as if COVID never happened. I got helicoptered from Ibiza to Mallorca and spent 2 months in a coma and lost all my body was destroyed by the coma, because you're dead. Damn. When you're in a coma. You don't roll around like you're asleep. You've got a machine taking every breath for you 20,000 times a day, and every major muscle just disappears. You're like a corpse. And I was wheeled out of there into an airport full of kids as soon as Bunga Bunga Boris released his flying monkeys, because he knew that Delta was going to ravage the UK. So he said, everybody go on holiday.
Yep.
And he spread it all over the world. And it was unbelievable. Now they were wheeling me through and I was just going, what are you all doing here?
Yeah.
This thing's a killer.
Oh.
You know, I'm very happy to remind people that terrible thing happened, and that some very, very bad people made not just lots of money out of it, but kind of probably killed people. Let's be frank. And I don't think they plotted. It's more like corporate manslaughter. But they arranged to have mass gatherings of people during a global pandemic. And that's, we were the peace and love generation. How did we become, you know, the plague and murder generation? How did that happen? It's just absolutely mental how much it's reversed. And of course, in my second book, I talk very much about what's happened to us, how it changed from X to Y.
Yeah.
And we've become literally, we're like a gigantic Darth Vader. We've literally become, you know, cheeky little Anakin to evil killer Darth Vader. And we have actually become the opposite of what we set out to be, which was, you know, a universal protest movement of love and peace into, you know, a hideously rapacious business monster that just eats everything in its path.
As I've said, as many have said, you're fighting the good fight, you know, on every front. But let's rewind a tiny bit just to go into that thing about the importance of great audio, because you kind of mentioned that you were basically funding the secret DJ these nights with you know, rock stars, sound technicians and handmade sound systems and all this kind of thing. You know, why did you invest so much in giving people that sonic experience? What does that experience mean to you, the great sound?
There's a lot of your kind of, I call them Balearic silverbacks, so you know, your rave dads rave dads, you know, they've all got golden ears. You know, they're like wine experts. It's like, oh yeah, that, you know, that's so warm, and this vinyl's this, and it's there's an element of taking that to task and saying, really, you really think that this is quality audio listening through through your, I won't name any brands, but you know, listening through your bog standard Japanese mixer. You know, it's like, well, this is actually, because I used to test people around at my house when we had after parties, which was every Sunday for many, many, many decades. Nice. And I'd have the most equipment in my room, and I'd had long leads on the speakers, bring the speakers into the other room where everybody was spazzed out, you know. And these are industry people. They're producers, they're engineers, the DJs a lot of the time. And I would say, which is the MP3, which is the WAV, which is the vinyl?
Oh.
And you know what the failure rate was? 99%.
Oh.
Everybody got it wrong all the time. Wow. And I'm talking about getting all three of them wrong.
Yeah.
Thinking that the vinyl's the MP3. And you know, I mean, it's not a rigorous peer review test with a lab coat on. It was a load of, you know, it was a basket full of twits. But it was including me. But and Andy Cale, who does my systems for the who I work with. He's done sound systems for DC-10 and for Cream and for, you know, he's the go-to guy in our industry. And Andy got them all right.
Nice.
Because because golden taste buds like and golden ears do exist, but there's only about five of them, and they make perfumes for a living. You know, they're not a Balearic silverback who lives in Mitcham and is furious about Chelsea. You know, they're professionals. These are professional people, and they do exist, but you're not one of them. Because if you work, be your job. And I'm not saying people, you know, people are all idiots and I'm right, because I'm also incapable of telling a lot of the time. And this is the point of what I'm doing. I'm presenting the most, you know, the lowest noise floor, the highest quality sound system by the best guy in the industry. And it's not me. He's doing it. I'm not doing it, you know. Mm. And we're playing anonymously, so you don't know who's providing the music, and you don't know what the format is.
Yeah.
So we are playing vinyl. So we never play MP3s, because I'm willing to say on the record, MP3s weren't designed to annoy you. They're not shit. They're perfectly adequate, but they are highly compressed file, and they don't suit very, very large. Often, most club systems are in mono. People don't realize that. Mm. Most of them are.
Yeah.
You know, and there's this idea that, you know, in a sense, I mean, the format never made the vocals, you know, squeeze any tears out of you. They never made the rhythms more persuasive.
Yeah.
They never made the colours any more colourful. Nobody's ever run up to me in a DJ booth and said, you know, are you playing a WAV right now? Or is it AIFF? You know, it's just never happened.
Yes.
And I don't want to sound arrogant, but it's an amateur's discussion about an amateur thing, format. Mm. If you can tell the difference between a WAV and a vinyl, you're better than me. And there'll be people listening now going, I'm better than him. I am. I'm better than him because I can. But if I put you in a situation where you can't influence the outcome, you won't be able to tell, you know. Yeah, and there's also, you know, a lot of it's to do with the channel. You know, I mean, look, people master sound, you know, and they do it with digitally, and they, you know, they're playing this analog in inverted commas record, which actually has a completely digital process. I mock people who call themselves Bellary, because obviously I live in Ibiza, so I find it quite funny that somebody from Burnley calls themselves Bellary Dave or something, you know, but I also mock myself. I am one of the biggest Bellary silverbacks. I am one of the biggest fake sophisticates. So, you know, I'm one of them. But that kind of gets conveniently forgotten about when it's easier to point the finger. But, you know, I think if we've discovered anything in this conversation, is that the whole point of this thing is a bit iconoclastic. It's about poking the bear a little bit and saying, hang on a minute, that's not quite true, is it? And hang on a minute, can we talk about the facts for a minute? Hang on a minute, you know, can we be the highest end audio? And also, one of the reasons why I do the dark room is that it's a completely safe space. Completely. Yeah. Nobody knows what gender you are or what race you are or anything when it's pitch black.
Awesome.
You know, so again, it's about that kind of providing in audio terms, it's a low noise floor. We can do a low noise floor culturally as well as acoustically.
Nice.
So we can provide a completely flat, completely blank canvas where none of these arguments are relevant. Doesn't matter how Bellary you are if you come to our night, because nobody knows, nobody can see you. Doesn't matter what you wear, doesn't matter how much money you've got, nobody can criticize your shoes because they can't see. Only thing they can do is listen.
That's beautiful, beautiful. And speaking of listening,
accidentally beautiful. I should have that on my gravestone. Here lies a secret DJ, beautiful. Accidentally beautiful.
Oh, that is properly beautiful. I love it. And speaking of listening, where can people get hold of your mixes, your remixes, etc.? You know, where can we send them?
It's a secret. I put a space between each letter of the secret DJ on Mixcloud just so you couldn't search it. So if you want to find the secret DJ Mixcloud, you've got to put a space between each letter. Shooting myself in the foot as usual. But I tend to, the anonymous thing isn't just a gimmick. People all the time think, oh, it's such a big gimmick. And it has a gimmick bonus. I mean, it's a bonus gimmick, but it's not the reason why I do it. And a lot of the stuff is anonymous purposefully, including being hard to search for on Google. And we don't have time to do a conversation about the devaluation of music. So one of the reasons why I don't make records anymore is there's just no point. Yeah. You know, and that's a long and dark conversation, which we probably don't have time for, but I have written about. So, you know, again, so you can write the book. So I would say, you know, obviously, Terry Wogan of Techno, buy the book. So buy the book. If you buy the books, you'll understand. Yes. Yeah, it's a start. You'll understand a few things, you know.
Oh, fabulous. Okay, we're going to leave a few cues in the show notes there, a few clues even in the show notes to the book, to that Mixcloud, the secret Mixcloud. And speaking of your books, can we expect another volume of the Secret DJ book sometime?
Well, there is going to be a film.
Oh my God.
So, you know, phenomenal. There will be a third book that ties in with that. It won't be a book of the film. The film will be probably about stuff that happened in the first book. Amazing. But I think it'll be a good bit of timing would be to do the third book. What do they call it in America? A threequel. A third book that's a prequel to the others. I'm not sure how we're going to do it. I've got most of it written. Like I had, all the books were mostly written. They were either bits of other work dragged together, things that notes that were made, and they were just kind of more assembled than created, you know, like an FX kit. And I've got all the bits for this third one as well, but I will wait for years for this one because I think it will tie in very nicely with having a film come out. It might even be a TV series, you know what they like these days, but we're at the stage where we've got proper grown-up producers who've actually made some films.
Fantastic.
I've written the script. I'm a producer as well. We just try to find, you know, somebody like Netflix or HBO. It'd be brilliant, wouldn't it? You know, someone, one of those big guys to take it on. So we're at that stage where we're trying to shop it around. Obviously, what will happen is, you know, Johnny Depp will end up playing me and it'll be ridiculous. You know, it'll just be like, you know, Fear and Loathing in Ibiza and have absolutely no resemblance whatsoever to a small, weird Irish stroke northerner. You know, it'll have no comparison whatsoever to the books. And I'll have my head in my hands and everybody will go, you know, what did you do? Why did you betray us like this?
Oh, amazing. Yes, Johnny Depp's Burnley accent is to perfection. Yes.
It'll be on yet another ridiculous accent. Yeah. Yeah, but can't be as mad as mine.
I cannot wait. My goodness, that sounds fabulous. So listen, I've got one final question for you here.
Yes,
it's
buddy.
A question that we asked all of our VIP guests on Audio Talks, and that is to choose a track or two for our tidal playlist. So this, you know,
I've forgotten what I said. There's so many now. I have a fake email account just to deal with the volume of them that I never opened. Yeah, I found it now.
Obviously,
one of them's a crooked man. Parrot from Sheffield is one of the originators. Like he was, you know, one of the earliest, dance music DJs in the early 80s in Sheffield.
Yeah.
DJ Parrot is now calls himself Crooked Man as a producer. And everything he does is gold. It's incredibly slow, incredibly hypnotic, incredibly psychedelic, very basic as well. But if ever there was an example of this idea that kids are just better at everything naturally and old people are terrible, and that's being completely wrong. And the opposite is the case, is that somebody who's been doing it for a lifetime is definitely going to be better than somebody who's been doing it for 5 minutes. You know, it's just pure rave physics. And so, you know, Crooked Man has been around one of the longest, and he's also one of the best producers. So, anything by Crooked Man is worth looking at. He's got his own Bandcamp, but this one is called Nemesis, which is just very special. And then on the other side of the coin, I'm a big fan of jazz funk, and it's slightly funny, and but I take it quite serious because I do like a nice mad synth solo. You know, I do, there's just something special about a crazy synth solo. I'm a huge fan of any kind of, you know, George Duke-esque mod wheel flicking kind of bit of synth madness. So this is a friend of mine called Thule, and I say friend, we like digital buddies, and he takes like old jazz funk records, and then he doesn't edit them, he plays keyboards over the top of them, and they're amazing. And that's the kind of, it's a bit more Balearic rather than, the Crooked Man is pure, like, low-ceilinged, strobe-like dance music. And Thule is a bit more like, you know, outdoors at Barbarella's in Croatia.
Oh my goodness. That's, you just taking us away to two like parallel scenarios there. I absolutely love it. And I'm going to sprinkle a track that's actually taken from one of your own mixtapes, Secret DJ. It is Andre Bratton, Trummer Og Bass, just because it's just hits the spot.
Andrew loved that as well. Weathers was a big fan, yeah.
That's just made my day. Thank you.
He would play it at -8, of course.
It's got to be a chugger. That's yeah. Brilliant. I love it. Okay. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us.
On good luck editing that one. Edward Scissorhands.
Oh my goodness, absolutely. All right, so thank you so much for joining us on this very special Darkroom edition of the Audio Talks podcast. Thanks to you, the secret DJ.
Thanks.
Listeners, don't forget to subscribe, comment and share Audio Talks with your friends and family. If you're enjoying the Audio Talks series of podcasts, why not pop over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your favourite podcasts and leave a nice review. It really does mean a lot and it helps new listeners to get to know about the amazing guests that we talk to in every episode, like the secret DJ himself. In the meantime, for more exclusive content, some behind the scenes goodies and maybe even some competitions, feel free to connect with us over on the Instagram. You can find us at Audio Talks Podcast. We'll be back soon for more anthemic audio talks. See you next time.